My guest today on this Making Space podcast is the artist Sir Anthony Gormley, former winner of the Turner Prize and without a doubt one of the world's greatest living artists whose work is highly recognisable and much loved. We've known each other for over 20 years, which has been a joyful and uplifting experience for me. You are part of the Roundhouse family as a generous supporter, an inspiring friend and a creative guide. And I look at your sculpture on the roof of the Roundhouse every day. Today, I'm looking forward to hearing about your own creative journey and to reflect together on what the Roundhouse at 20 represents, both for artists and for the next generation coming through. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Marcus, for having me.
We have often talked about that wonderful substance called clay. In our digitally driven society, I suppose fewer people are having the opportunity to connect their brains, hearts, and hands. I wonder if you could describe what clay is, what it feels like to you, and why you give pieces of it to your guests when they come for dinner.
Oh, lovely question. It's lovely to be here. I mean, I just come in and through a room full of people doing stuff. I mean, admittedly, they're all in front of screens, but it's evident that this is a kind of creative nest where people with ideas try and turn them into reality. And I think what the Roundhouse means and what the Roundhouse does and what the Roundhouse represents is hope. And in a world where everything seems to be falling apart and where it seems to have fallen into the hands of the bandits, the alternative to business as usual, which essentially means raping the planet, has to come from individuals that have forged their own singular path. Maybe groups of individuals that have found each other in order to form a singular path that somehow tries to tread more lightly on the planet and realize that humankind is one form of life's myriad forms, and that intelligence doesn't belong only to our species, but it's distributed throughout the biosphere, and indeed evidence of intelligence can be found in the very formation of rocks. So human creativity as part of creation itself, in other words, as part of the becoming of the world, is our most important resource. And the Roundhouse is a place in which it is, you know, encouraged, sustained, allowed to grow, allowed to dream, allowed to, in a way, materialize itself. So it's precious. And, yeah, I'm very, very, you know, touched by your words, but I'm really proud that in a very small way I've been part of the evolution of this place and everything that you and Torkel Norman have done to make, I suppose, creativity valued and, more importantly, actually, you know, manifest here. So, clay. What is clay? Well, clay is a mountain that has made its way to the sea and has left tiny particles of the fundamental forms of rock that then becomes, you know, sedimentary at the bottom of a column of water. It's extraordinary stuff, because on the one hand it's very refined, and it has been refined by its own journey, as it were, from exposed tectonic plate to the sea via all of the action of water. And when you touch it, I'm making it sound very romantic, but it, you know, you can buy a 25 kilo bag of clay very easily, and you can get it delivered just like you're shopping these days. And I think that every house should have a 25 bag of clay, and not just one, but have a regular supply of clay, because I think that it grounds you. It's very simple. If you have this stuff, and it's better than any cosmetic, because this is a real material that has come through time and the action of the elements, and in touching it, you feel the extension of your body. You know that what you're made of and what the clay is made of is part of a continuum. And in reconnecting with it, you can start to think and to feel through making. And I think of making as a form of thinking and feeling pre-verbal. And we tend to think that actually thought is verbal. But we know now so much about consciousness, and that actually a lot of what we can attend to has nothing to do with the hermeneutics of language, has everything to do with the intuition of something, the knowledge of something, or the getting to know the becoming of something through touch, through smell, through sometimes sight, but that's less important because we have this intuitive sense. Anyway, I think just taking a ball of clay, forming it in the hands, it's almost like you don't have to have a preconception. You can allow it to kind of lead you on. And suddenly, you know, there, in the space between your hands, there is a kind of studio. This thing arises. You put it apart from you. And there is a materialized feeling that hasn't had to have a word. And I think that's the wonderful thing about creativity, really. We don't, you know, if we allow it to arise, and the whole nature of creativity is play, the way that anything that I think shares the world with us asks us to, in some way, recognize that the world has changed, and that now we have to look at it differently.
I feel clay. I used to make pots a lot when I was a child. I think I found the world almost incomprehensible when I was a teenager. And the only bits of my life that kind of made me feel at one with myself, I suppose, were the moments when I was feeling clay, and the other one was when I was making music. Both are very abstract, but both are very real. They're the two things that we're probably given when we're born. You know, you can touch things and make things with your hands, and it, you feel it in your body. And the other one is you're given a voice and you can make sounds, and you can make sounds with your hands. Everything else, pencils are made, you know, computers are made, everything else is made, but we're given very few things at our starting point of our life. And it's something that I feel the more that our education system is driven to not to include creativity and the imagination, the more that our higher education and further education is being driven to, you know, we even hear it in the last couple of weeks, that, you know, to push out the low quality courses like creative arts. You know, you hear this again and again and again. And then this, we devalue. Why do you think society is so frightened, or it's so pervasive, that creativity is not as important as other things in our life, in education especially?
That's a really big question, but I think on the whole, you know, our education has been formulated by, in a way, teaching to test. So the degree to which, you know, everything that I just said cannot be tested because there are no norms, there are no metrics.
Yeah.
And it's for me, total diminishment of what it means to be human if we only value things that can be measured. The tragedy of, I think, the myopia of education that is only seen as providing the tools for gainful employment. You know, education has failed if it doesn't link us with the thing that makes us feel alive, that makes us feel happy, that makes us feel purposeful and fulfilled. And I think the fact is that art has been a fundamental tool in our survival, in our knowing, in a way, ourselves and the world. To leave it out of a school curriculum, I mean, I think we've succeeded now. I mean, I was part of a big campaign to make sure that art was put back into the curriculum. But it's funny, art is something that can't really be taught, but it can be provided for, the space, the time, and the materials for, in a way, opening the gates of creative making can be provided, and then all that is necessary is the attention and the encouragement. You know, I wouldn't be sitting here today if I hadn't had wonderful art teachers at school.
So I wanted to come on to that actually a bit, but before, something you just said then, which was about being purposeful. Of course, for me, the arts have given me everything. A bit of sport when I was a kid as well, but I found the world, as I said, very complicated, but it was the arts that gave me meaning, purpose and direction. And you use the word purposeful, and of course, when we feel purposeful about our lives or happy in our lives or those together, then everything else seems much more possible, doesn't it? And that, I think, is why one of the reasons why young people are finding it so difficult now, that we've invested wrongly into young people, and treading the boards into the future is going to be more and more complicated until we think about young people in a completely different way. So, coming back to your childhood, I was wondering, it sounds pretty Victorian-ish when what the things that I've read about.
Yeah, well, it was well organised.
but you found a space in your shed, is that right? I've been doing a little bit more research than the stories you told me. This little series of podcasts called Making Space. Do you think your shed is where your imagination was allowed to develop? And if it was that space, or was there a teacher, or was there a grandmother, I think, or grandmother that encouraged you to draw, or was it a combination of all these things?
It's,
or was it
really
just something aching inside?
It's really simple, Marcus. I think you need to be able to make a mess. You need to be able to mess about with stuff, whether that's paint or plaster or, you know, anything, really. And the... maybe we're over kind of instructed by the false worlds of televised drama, or, you know, the world of, if you like, the film, that somehow the hygiene of the domestic interior seems to be absolutely antithetical to making a mess. And but making a mess is really fun, and well, I mean, no, I think you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs, and I think that's equally true for art. So it is just really important. I mean, for me, managing to escape the domestic diktats of home and making a little laboratory, I called it a laboratory because it wasn't really a studio, in the garden shed was a really important thing. And I've done that. I mean, you know, that was probably my first studio. And then we made one at the bottom of the garden in my Peckham house. And yes, studios for me are this open area where actually anything can happen.
And that's the thing, isn't it, where anything can happen. Because if you restrict yourselves at the starting point of a process, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
Or very limited things. And I think that's same with a young musician in one of the Roundhouse studios, or some of my colleagues in the booth behind us, you know, they allow young people to experiment. And that process of trying something and what people may say is failure, although I'd never say that, it's just development, isn't it? Is that risk-taking in a confined environment is such an important thing in our lives, because unless we risk something, we're never going to move on in life either. And the arts are a wonderful way to explore your own potential.
It's really interesting, this, you know, what do you learn most from? And I think that the truth is, when you say, oh, you know, that didn't work, or that was a failure, well, you learn a lot from that. And actually, you may not know. You may not know whether it was or it wasn't. So I'm in the middle of, like, trying to sort out all my drawings. And I came across a whole load of drawings that I must have made in, like, the mid-80s, so 40 years ago, that I'd ripped up, but I hadn't actually thrown the things away. They were quite a big drawing. And I'd ripped them, I'd sort of torn them up into pieces, but, you know, along folds. Anyway, I rescued 4 out of the 10, the bits that I could find that fitted together. And my perspective on them now is that they're not as bad as I thought that they were whenever it was that I ripped them up. So this thing of what constitutes success, very, 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 difficult to pin down. And I think you obviously you've got to use your discriminatory intelligence or whatever. Having made something, the next job is to live with it and to maybe just see how it feels the next day. Then maybe show your mum or your partner or your friends. And then try the experiment, which is usually, like, in my case, just put it out on the road and see what happens. It's an interesting thing that, you know, so what I'm thinking is that there are levels of filter, and we can so often find ourselves editing value, not from the point of view of the origination of the work, but from some cultural kind of outside stance that is to do with feeling about what is and what is not allowed. Anyway, I think you learn from failure, but failure itself is a category that needs to be taken with a grain of salt.
When you're thinking of your work and you put it out on the street, and then when you have a final vision in mind for where it's going to go, how much time do you spend thinking about the place and the community, the people? And do you ever go and talk to the people first? And
no, but that is my ideal, you know, that a work is, in a sense, conceived and evolved in and with a place. Mm. So, you know, the thing that everybody knows about my work is the Angel of the North. Now, I couldn't have made that without thinking about, well, everything about that region and the history of coal mining, the history of engineering, the way in which coal and iron ended up as ships and, you know, huge steam trains and bridges and cast iron buildings that were sent to Australia. That history of the Northeast as the workshop of the world, really. I mean, in the late 19th century. And I think it was very much about recognizing that a site, a place for a work, is not a geographical location findable on a map or out there, you know, in the elements. It's also the history and living truth of the population that lives there, which is not just human, but also all of the birds and the animals. And I think that's really that thing of saying, well, where is this thing going to live and how will it be rooted in that place? That actually contributes a lot then to the evolution of the work itself. So, the angel is a reflection on the hull of a ship, but sort of turned inside out. It's made of ship plate, you know, what the hulls of those ships that were launched onto the Tyne over 200 years. And, well, I think that the reason that it works is that it is literally but also kind of imaginatively rooted in that place, which is a mixture of where it is, the Lower Team Colliery, you know, just over the hill from Tyne, but then also where it is in history, but also where it is in terms of human experience.
I absolutely loved seeing it in its site. I grew up in Cumbria and used to go on my youth orchestra courses over in Newcastle and experience that area and still love it today. I think there's a vibrancy about the people and imagination and sense of kind of ability, which is extraordinary. But I'm really pleased you talked about that sense of community, identity, landscape, everything in from the birds and the animals. So just coming to the sculpture that you made for the roundhouse, which I'm looking at right now over your shoulder, which is very strange to be seeing two Anthony Gormleys at the same time, one made out of iron. You were incredibly busy around that time, about 2005. It was put into place in mid-2006. What was it about the roundhouse and what is it about? Because it's a very humanising figure for the roundhouse, which, you know, can look quite big and maybe look quite scary to some people, although I don't feel that. But and we spent a lot of time thinking about the angle of the neck, which way, what to looking up to Kentish Town or down to Camden Town or up to Primrose Hill, but actually looking over toward Kentish Town. Can you talk a little bit about the meaning behind the sculpture and why you wanted to make it in the first place?
I think, you know, the roundhouse is like a great big spaceship, isn't it? A sort of flying saucer that's landed at the bottom of Haverstock Hill.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I was particularly interested in that view as you come down the hill, where I wanted to break the silhouette, as it were, of the edge of the buildings and then have this work that is attending to the ground, you could say, or to the road. So it's about making connection. It's an antenna, really. It's like, well, we've got satellite dishes that do something very different, but are looking up to Starlink or wherever it is that they're trying to. I'm trying to make a connection to people, whether they're moving in cars or walking or bicycling past, and, yeah, sort of make them recognize that here is a place where people are thinking about being human, how they might share those thoughts. So that all sounds a bit abstract. I think for me, I wanted to make a, it may sound strange, but I wanted to make a standing stone for a roof that linked what was going on here between the sky that is, for me, well, the Tibetans have this wonderful term. They call it the sky nature of mind. What does that mean? Well, it means that our mind, you know, we contain this faculty of being able to have infinite dreams, infinite extension. In our mind, we can go anywhere. But I wanted then to make that thought grounded. So that looking down is also, I hope, in the attitude of the body, this thing of being rooted to this place. Anyway, it's a huge privilege, and I'm very honoured, really, to, I think, have this work that is, you know, it's not symbolic. It is, whatever, 630 kilos of concentrated earth. I think of iron as a kind of concentrated earth, really. And, yeah, I hope it works as a kind of magnet or a lodestone, so people might look up and say, well, what's that? And what's that doing there? And then they might ask somebody, you know, as they walk past.
We have questions all the time. We have phone calls all the time, even phone calls nowadays and emails. People talk about it all the time. And they ask who it is. And then they realize, because I believe it's your first sculpture on a roof.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Well, it's quite possible. I just wanted it to be seen against the sky. It was very important to me that, in a way, we had this very massive, you know, because it's very important to me that this is not hollow. I mean, most of the bronze, you know, statues that you see around are hollow. And then it was also very important to me that it is one limb, if you like. So it's a body, but it's in the form of a fish. In other words, there are no identified extensions. You know, there's a head and there's a body, but it's all one form. And it's doing the equivalent to a body space to what the sea does to a lump of flint. It smooths it and makes it sit in relation to space, I think, with this kind of, I suppose, clarity of form. So I wanted it to be very quiet, just to have a feeling of what happens when you perhaps have that moment of being in a particular place and you feel rooted, or you feel that you are there at one with the place. And I don't know where, I don't know whether people get that. But it is about attitude. It's not kind of gesturing in a meaningful way. It's not a freeze frame in some kind of narrative. It's just about being and the potential that comes with having a human life.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that thousands of young people that we work with every year, I think it was 11,400 in the last year at the Roundhouse, many of them talk about the Roundhouse as their creative home from home, a place where they feel free or they feel rooted in a safe environment where they can explore their creativity. So I think there is something, we had a conversation before we started recording about stupors, and I was thinking about gravity, and your sculpture certainly has a gravity about it, as in things are magnetized towards it. And often you hear people talking about, oh, I'd really attract that. I didn't realize, or I've been past three times, then suddenly, and I can't keep my eyes off the sculpture now. But for me, it says, this is a place for people. It is a place where you can be the person you want to be. And I often think that when people come through those doors into the main space, if they're seeing a show and their eyes lift up to those incredible iron rafters. And, you know, as Peter Brook used to say, it lets the imagination soar. That's what he said about the Roundhouse all those years ago.
We need all these places that are like, you know, our brain boxes have a vault, which is kind of the cusp of the skull. And I think of, you know, the Roundhouse is like a cathedral or like any of the round churches that, you know, the Knights Templars brought back from Jerusalem. That it's just a place where, yeah, you're that potential within your mind to expand can be realized. It's wonderful.
When does creativity happen? Or, you know, because Bernstein talked about that moment between being awake and being asleep, and he even had a whole load of ways of making sure that he was in that moment. He would kind of half wake up and the creativity would flow out of him. I sat next to you at a number of dinners, and there's a pencil and a notepad, and you can start drawing, and you're looking at everything. You look at everything like this, like burning into the heart of it, and you probably don't realize that, but you're drawing. And where does that moment of the moment that you take your thoughts of imagination and they are then something into a form in front of you? How, is there a special moment for you?
I don't know. I think it can happen any old time, and you just got to, it's useful to have some way of getting it down. So I always do have a notebook and a pencil or a pen somewhere about me. And I always have it by the side of my bed. So if there is, and it is an interesting interlude between sleeping and waking. And I'm playing this game with myself where I'll read The Guardian from cover to cover, usually missing out the kind of arts bit in the middle, an opinion bit in the middle. And then I might read that either at the end of the day or the beginning of the day. And then the next morning, I will try, before I start the new Guardian, to remember as many of the pages and double page spreads as I can.
Wow.
But it's just to do with, I suppose, the fact that daily life now at this, you know, I'm 76 this year, and I just realized that I think that my daily life is becoming a bit more like a dream. In other words, I can't remember it. So I have to find ways of kind of reinforcing my memory because it's faulty. I'm treating it very similarly to the way I try to recover dreams. And it hasn't been so easy of late. But I mean, I have always noted my dreams. Always. I think of them as a gift. I did go to a shrink for a long time, and I used to bring my precious little dreams, and I think that was a bad use of them, to be honest, even though it gave us plenty to talk about. I think it's just the feeling and the images that come from dreams are really precious ways of, I think, getting behind the appearance of things. When recording your dreams, recording the feeling, the atmosphere is as important as the incidents, you know.
Because we're so trained for narrative, aren't we?
Yeah. We're always looking for, in a way, a story, but it may not be that straightforward. And It's more like how one image transforms into another or goes into, fuzzy mode. And then even if you can only remember particular incidents, could be just the turn of a smile on somebody's face or the smell of the room. Or I don't know why I'm so attached to that ground, but that space that is between, I suppose most of our daily lives are purposeful. Well, they are to do with cause and effect, to do with, as it were, known goals. I've got to get to school by 9 o'clock or whatever, and we're strategizing, finding ways of which I'm going to. But, before all of that, you could say goal-orientated action, which can take up all of your energy and all of your attention. It's quite important to just, recognize that there's another whole thing going on. And the dreams are a way of, accessing that.
It's interesting. I wrote down a question beforehand, but it's actually a slightly developed from the question, which is, you're talking about dreams and how they might maybe potentially influence some of your work, but have you ever started a sculpture, and maybe this happens all the time, or a drawing or a pot, and it takes on a life of its own, and you find yourself as the facilitator of the idea rather than the maker of the idea?
Yeah, I think that happens all the time for me, particularly with drawing, because it is just, it is about making a mess in a way. You're there with your whatever it is you're drawing with, which might be, of late it's been, ink cap ink. So the Deliquest black from a ink cap mushroom that I pick at just the right moment, usually in mid-October, and just put them into jars, and they just disintegrate into this incredible viscous black stuff, which has its own particular and wonderful characteristic. It's like a kind of album, and it's like the white of an egg, so it has a kind of slightly stretchy sort of gooiness. But it's really fun to use. So I might disperse it on a wet piece of paper and then it's like reading tea leaves, because there's this whole thing going on, and there are whole landscapes appearing with kind of, deltas of, as the water kind of runs out from the pigment. And I might just, I'd say I don't know what this is, but it's really fascinating. Or, I might make a body and then try to make it part of a wider system. So it is like just seeing what the affordance is, what's happening here on this ground. And it's not really about intentionality, even though I might have drawn the shape of a body or the form of a body. But often I'm not very conscious of that either. So there will be an attitude in the body that I'm thinking, oh, goodness, that's really floaty. Or, oh, that looks very compressed. Or, I'm trying to now find words for things that maybe don't need to be given words, so that there's an attitude there. And then I've got to try to connect that attitude with the ground that surrounds it, and that's really fun. I mean, it's just really, really fun. I love the whole, we talked about taking lumps of clay and allowing this thing to arise in the space between your hands, but I'm just as excited about seeing what arises on a wet piece of paper with pigments that, in a way, don't come out of a tube but come out of the ground.
And that's a beautiful organic kind of journey, isn't it? From you hunting the mushrooms to them
developing, so nice.
To, having that whole journey with this material. I've got a couple of final questions.
Yeah.
I just say that you read The Guardian from cover to cover. I hope you read my letter in The Guardian this morning.
I didn't get this morning. I'm afraid I had to leave before I picked up my paper, but I will look forward to getting it tomorrow.
I've thought a lot about something you said. Where do you go to when you close your eyes? I thought about where I go to when I close my eyes. I hear Bach cello suites.
Tortelier or Cassals.
Actually, a French cellist called Marc Coppi, who I got really into during... I loved Tortelier, but slightly overplayed for me, but really, really beautiful. Then my mind, I allow it to drift. And what you're talking about, infinite possibility, or you know, the Tibetan word you used.
The sky nature of mind.
The sky nature. Where do you go when you close your eyes? What happens?
Well, I think the difficulty for all of us is to stop the chattering kind of mind box doing its monkey work. But if you can really just stop all of that, and it is useful just to concentrate on the breath. Sorry, I'm trying to do that now. Concentrate on the breath, which is a sort of, it's like a fireman's pole. It takes you into the body. And then you find you're in this place. So you slip down the greasy pole of the breath. And then you're in this space of darkness, which isn't about loss or pain or anything bad or negative, but is this sort of place of possibility that has no objects, seems infinitely extensive, maybe the freest place that any of us can experience, and it is right there waiting for you the whole time. We are told that we are individuals and that, you know, we are important because of the specialness of each and every one of our experiences, which of course is true. But equally true is the fact that inside each and every one of us is this sublime place of infinity, of infinite extension and infinite possibility. And you can't spend your whole life there. But I love going back to the darkness of the body, which for me is, just so full of power and possibility. And it's a funny thing because, you know, you could say, well, you're talking about nothing. You're talking about no things. But in the space where there are no things, everything is possible. Anyway.
I have so many other questions to ask you, but it would be ruining a beautiful moment to ask any of them.
Okay.
And maybe one day in the future.
Well, we can do it again, can't we?
But Anthony, thank you so much. That was the fastest bit of time I've ever experienced.
That was nice. Thank you for asking me.
And you're 76. I can't believe that because you cycled over. You've got more energy than most people that I know put
together. No, it's my knees now. Oh. My knees. I've been promised 2 half Oxfords, nice titanium bearing plates on both my knees, which will mean that I can get back onto the skis and things.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much for today and helping us make some space.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.